Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, we're going to be answering the question as to why house prices are so high. And to address this question, I've got back Peter Laurie,
Dan,
friend of the show. Good to have you back. Thanks so much to seeing you again. But also Ian Lush. Thank you very much for coming on, Ian. Now, you flagged this on a previous Brokenomics that you've got a sort of a thing into a property developers.
Yeah, there's three of us run a small niche house builder, if you like. Ian is obviously a co-director and we've got a third partner as well. And I think we had a quick conversation about why houses cost what they cost and why do they take so long to deliver. And we thought it might make some good material. So we're here to...
And you called in Ian, who is dealing with this on a daily basis. So thank you very much for coming. Tell me about Lawlish.
Is it Lawlish is actually a combination of our surnames, if you look at it. So And not that we came up with the name. I think it was actually Ian's wife came up with the name.
Mm. Okay.
We spent a few hours trying to work out the name and then his wife came up with the answer.
But you're not a big time developer. You're not pumping out thousands.
We're what you would call an SME builder. So anywhere between 1 and 500 units. And you'll realise the relevance of that when we come to talk about what we're going to talk about. But we both have had city careers. Yes. And then post Great Financial Crisis in 2010, I think it was, Ian, we started this.
Yep.
And I think we've learned a lot along the way. We build sites of around anywhere between sort of 3 and 10 houses.
Each individual site being about 3 to 10 houses.
Yeah, 3 to 10 houses. Mostly on brownfield sites, to be perfectly honest. We've developed a few garages. We can talk about garage developments if you want. That's something we have some expertise in.
Yep.
Not easy, but normally good sites. So, we're a private house builder. Simon as well, who's obviously can't be here today, but.
But the main take there being is that you are in the development business, but you're not one of the majors, and therefore you're not carrying any water for them. So you can have a poke at where you think they go wrong and where they might sometimes unfairly be accused of things.
Yeah, we can have a very broad conversation. Now, we have experience as a small house builder. We don't have any experience as a large house builder, but we can certainly give you our opinion on the whole process, because we don't just buy land and sell it. We buy land for our company, and we take it all the way through, develop it, and take it through to the sales process. We do the whole thing,
and so therefore you're exposed to all aspects of this. You know, the planning rules around it, the development rules, all of the building regs, all of that kind of stuff. So you have a very clear sense in your mind as to why houses cost what houses cost.
Why they cost what they cost, and why they take so long to deliver.
Right. Which I suppose is the key element, really.
It's certainly a major factor in why they cost what they cost. And we have some ideas as well on how the whole process can be improved. And if we've got time, we can touch on those as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what the key message I think we want to leave people is this is a very, very misunderstood industry. Everyone thinks it's very profitable. Everyone sees headline numbers of what house prices cost, but most people in the population don't understand actually what goes into this. The costs and the amount of effort it takes to build a small site, even an individual unit, takes a lot of effort.
Yes.
So we'll dismiss some theory, some sort of theories along the way, I guess.
Okay. So, but before we get into the granular detail of, you know, individual properties and the process that you go through, what's, I know you've got some thoughts on the sort of the macro picture that's going on here. Where would you come at that?
I mean, the conclusion is there's a massive supply demand imbalance. Yeah. And there has been for effectively going back to the Second World War, we've never built enough units in this country. So clearly when supply doesn't meet demand, the balancing item is price. And we can look at some of the factors, if you like, going
yes,
through that.
Please, yeah, do. So, please do.
So I'm going to first piece of evidence. We're going to look at something called the Lyons Review,
okay.
Which I hate doing this. There's two things I don't like about this review. Firstly, it's nearly 10 years old. I don't like using old data, but it was incredibly comprehensive review of the housing sector. Yeah. So it is worth looking at because the lessons that came from it are still relevant today.
And this was a Labour Party document, was it?
Yeah, it was.
Or they commissioned it or something.
Yeah, it was commissioned under Ed Miliband in 2013, published in 2014 to look at the problems in the housing sector. So it's an old report, don't like using
it. So we're not holding up Ed Miliband as being any sort of sage on this. The point is that they went away and they found a lot of underlying data. So irrespective of what we think about the conclusions or the political points that might have come out of this.
Yeah.
The underlying data was, well, there's just pages and pages of it.
It's quite revealing. It is, and I think, and we'll go on to make some assumptions about where that data has gone in the more recent past as well. So yes, it's politically sourced, hate doing that. Yes, it's old. We can give you a bit of an update to it as well, but it was incredibly comprehensive. Clearly Ed Miliband didn't get his hands dirty doing this. He employed the great and the good in the housing market. Some of whom had obviously biases, but others were quite independent. And they produced this report. It's available on the internet. It's worth looking at. So that was the Lyons Review. It came to two main conclusions, and they are quite politically motivated, if you like, because obviously Labour weren't in power at the time.
Yes.
But the two main conclusions is there's not enough land being brought forward for development. I'd slightly debate that today. I think there is enough land out there, but that was one of their conclusions. And the other revealing conclusion they came to is there were too few houses being built. Well, it didn't take a rocket scientist and a year to work that one out. But they went into some of the reasons why. And I think that's the interesting bit. Now, what you need to, the one nugget of information you need to know is that the private sector in the UK does and has always produced roughly 80% of the housing stock in any one year on average. Okay. And the public sector produces the remaining 20%. So that's housing trusts and things like that. So what we're talking about here is 80%, the vast majority of the house building industry producing units. The chart you've put up now, so the first bit of data that is revealing is the scale of the companies who are building houses. Now, this is 10 years old, but the trend it shows you, firstly, is there are fewer houses being built today than there were even 20 years ago. And secondly, it's the blue sectors you want to look at. The SME builders have been absolutely decimated in the last 20 years.
So to get a handle on this, what we're looking at here is a line chart for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And it's color-coded with the darkest blue at the bottom being developers who produce under 100 houses a year, presumably.
Yeah, so that would be the likes of us.
Okay, and then you've got between 100 and 500, 500 and 2,000, over 2,000. So the red bit at the top is the majors.
Yeah.
Now, looking back in the early part of the 80s and throughout the 80s, what we're seeing is a lot of supply is coming from small developers.
Not only a lot. The bulk, 57% of the UK's houses in the 80s was produced by SME builders.
Yes, it is a lot of them. And then the rest of it is kind of made up with the larger developers. And there is a notable place for the majors in this picture. But during the 80s, they're, well, I don't know, 15, 20%, whatever that is. Something around that
of the majors. Well, if the smaller guys were producing it, at a peak, it was 57% of the houses. So the absolute majors Okay. We're producing, you know, 43%, less than half of the private housing stock.
And then what we see as the years go by is the small developers just dwindle and dwindle away.
Yeah.
And the red part, the majors, they just sort of consume.
They're pretty static. Yeah, they're producing roughly, and I'll come on to show you how many units the majors produce. They're pretty static.
No, actually, that's a good point. It looks like they're consuming the line, but actually, the bit for the majors is holding reasonably consistent.
Reasonably steady.
And it's just the rest of it that's shrinking away.
It's collapsing. And you can see,
that's interesting.
So the trend of small builders, the number of small builders, yeah, is down. And every time you have a recession, it's dramatically down. They never recover.
Oh, yes, 2008. So,
yeah,
1992.
Yeah, the big recessions wipe out small builders and they never come back. And they were responsible in the 80s for more than half of the house building in this country. And we're going to discuss what the impact of that, and we're going to give you some real life anecdotes of what life is like as a small builder.
Oh, good.
So that's basically the number of small house builders in the last 20 years has fallen 75% in the UK.
Yeah.
So you've got this 57% of production that's fallen 75%.
Yes.
That is dramatic. Now, you can ask why, and we're going to go into detail, but I'll give you the headlines now. It's sort of the cost of building houses, the amount of regulation, the hassle of building houses, and the low returns. That's why the small building sector has been pretty much decimated. But as I say, we'll put some flesh on the bones of those those comments. We'll discuss our experiences. There was a more recent, there's lots of surveys, but a more recent one that caught our eye was actually done earlier this year. And it came from Close Brothers, property finance people, the Home Builders Federation, so an independent organization of builders, and Travis Perkins, the big aggregates and supplier of house building products. And so it's not just us that's having a whinge about what's going wrong in the industry. When you look at some of the conclusions which are on screen now, 93% of small builders said that securing planning was a big problem. That's the hassle factor.
But what do we mean by planning? This is basically approval from your local council, is it?
Yeah, we'll come on to this. This is going to be a big part of what we discuss, is the planning process. And 93%, I don't know who the other 7% were who didn't have a problem with planning, but 93% of small builders said it's a problem. Hmm. It's a dramatic problem and causes huge delays and lack of supply, ultimately. Because we are looking at the supply side of the argument here at the moment.
Yes.
I'll come on to demand in a minute. A big one, I like the third bullet point down. This is something we've noticed a lot in the recent past, post-COVID. 76%, so three quarters of builders, think that staffing shortages in local authorities on the planning side is a big problem.
Because you just can't do anything until you've got the man with a rubber stamp who...
Yeah.
Or the red stamp that says you can go ahead.
Says, yes, you can go ahead. Right. And we're going to discuss some of those delays, how long it takes, the cost of it, how many snouts are in the trough on that one as well. It's always a good thing to talk about. So you can see from this, we won't go into too much detail on this, but it's not just us in this podcast having a whinge. The whole industry is upset with the system, effectively. So, yeah. Now, if we move on to the next chart, this just graphically shows. So this is SMEs. It shows you this 75% decline in builders. And this was up to 2013. Now, I haven't managed to find any up-to-date data on how many small builders are in the UK.
Well, the trend is pretty clear on this. Mm. I mean, what we're seeing, I mean, this is very similar to the earlier chart, but it's just a bit clearer. It's focused on the small ones. So the small and medium-sized builders, good proportion of them back in the 80s, and the line has just gone down.
Straight down.
Down and down.
Yeah. I mean, it's gone from 12,000 companies in the 80s.
Yep.
I would guess today it's less than 2,500, which wouldn't be a problem if the big boys had made up the difference. So if we can flip on to the next chart. Now, this also comes from the Lions Review. What it shows, and remember it is slightly out of date, is the corporate activity amongst the big house builders in the UK. In the early part of the noughties. And as you can see, all the big boys started buying each other. So let's just pick the top line. Persimmon bought Beazer, January 2001. And what you notice is the trend is when there's corporate activity, the combined house building capacity of the two parties to that activity drops in every instance.
Yeah, in every case. So I'm looking down this list. So George Wimpy bought McAlpine.
Yeah, and the combined
collectively 14,500.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that goes straight down to 12,000 after the deal.
Yeah. So it's a 16% drop after the deal in combined house building capacity.
But having bought that, George Wimpy then also buy Lang.
Yeah.
And the collective entity there was producing 13.5,
yeah,
which goes down to 12.
And then compound the problem, Taylor Woodrow bought George Wimpy.
Yep.
And the combined entity of what is there four companies then drops another nearly 40%.
So it went from 20. So the separate entities were combining 20. We're producing 22,000 units,
and they're down. And
it goes to 13.5.
Yeah, yeah.
So
not only are the big boys not making up the difference for the loss of small house builders, yes, they're buying each other because it was an attractive thing to do at the time, and the combined capacity.
But these mergers are not resulting in a bigger beast.
No,
it's effectively just taking out a competitor.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. That is.
Yeah. So yes, and you can see. Another thing I want to throw in, and we'll come back to this in a little while, I'll prove it with receipts. The second from bottom, when Barrett bought Wilson Bowden.
Yeah.
And this was January 2007. The combined entity produced 17,000 houses. Yep.
Yep.
Last year, Barrett produced 17,000 houses. So their capacity has not gone up in the last 16 years.
Yep. Despite the fact that before that deal that you talked about, it was
20,000. Yep.
In every case, you know, the big developers have just been eliminating competition but not increasing supply in any way.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we've had various politicians in the last number of years promise 300,000 houses a year. The UK has never built 300,000 houses in 1 year.
Even back ever. In the 80s and
no,
when it was...
No, okay. Not go back to the Second World War. Even when they were throwing prefab houses up after the war, they still didn't produce 300,000 houses. Now, you've got to think, that wasn't a problem after the war because we didn't have the size of population we've got today. The population of the UK, I'm going to discuss that in a minute because we don't actually know what it is.
Well, quite.
But it was a lot less then than it is now. There wasn't the demand side of the equation as well.
They didn't have quite the open door policies that we have today either.
Dan, I'm not getting into that one.
Yes.
Well, we can if you want. So the supply conclusion, if you like, is there are drastically fewer smaller builders producing a lot less units, and there are fewer large builders producing less units.
Okay, but the criticism that you always get, the pushback you always get, is that the large developers are just hoarding,
yeah, okay,
massive amounts of supply,
yeah,
and they're just sitting on it for some reason.
Yeah, okay, so this is where we get slightly technical and geeky, which this is where I'm going to lose maybe some of the audience, but I'll try and make it as clear as I can.
Yeah.
What you have on the screen now is a section of last year's report and accounts from the UK's largest house builder, which is Barratt Developments.
Okay.
And I refer to them building 17,000 units a year. And actually, you can see if you dissect these numbers.
It tells me there that they're sitting on 80,000 sites.
Yeah.
Which is almost 5 years worth.
Yeah. Yeah. But you need to look at the technical definitions here. What they're actually sitting on is 3 years worth of land bank. So the key number there is the top line, plots with detailed planning consent.
Oh, okay.
That is developable plots.
So that's stuff that's actually gone through the local authority machine.
The man with the big rubber stamp, the big red rubber stamp, has said yes.
Okay, and anything before that can be just, it could be all over the place.
Yes, it could be in any sort of situation, but it can't be developed.
So they're only actually sitting on three. And actually, when you start to think about the process of allocating, you know, men and resources and stuff, three years is that sounds kind of reasonable.
I don't think, and Ian can confirm it, have we ever developed a small site in 3 years from beginning of the process to the end?
No.
So you imagine if you're doing a 1,000 house site, how long that takes to get planning, to build it, to sell it.
Well, and just lining up all the, you know, getting your ducks in a row.
So
I was sorry to interrupt, Pete, just to throw in a comment there about that. If you look at the entire time it takes to bring a piece of land forward from, if you like, zero to finished houses, you could be 6 months to a year in discussion figuring out the deal. Then you've got to go through the whole planning process, which, depending on how complicated it actually becomes, could be a year, could be 18 months, could be 2 years, could be 5 years. Then you've got to build the site. So depending on how big it is, whether it's five houses or 50, you've got a time frame that goes with that. So it's quite reasonable to be thinking in terms of 3 to 5 years ahead at any one point for what you might be planning to do in the future. And the bigger companies, of course, will have this down to a fine art. Yeah. It's not really about anyone trying to bank lots of land in order to manipulate the market. It's about making sure your business has the wherewithal to deliver housing in the future.
Yeah, I can't really criticize them for having a sort of a pipeline of 3 years.
Absolutely.
When what you're delivering is houses. But those bigger numbers that I'm seeing on there, I mean, there is a reference to a 93,000.
Yeah.
But is that largely options or something?
Yeah. So that will be land that they're currently negotiating to buy, and probably under option or some sort of agreement.
But this is if it's under option, it's very speculative. It's just like...
Because of the size of this company, it's probably greenfield. Because they don't buy little garages in the middle of a village. They need somewhere they can put 1,000 units. So this is where you see the big developments on the side of towns or whatever. So there's lots of more considerations with greenfield land. So it's a longer process.
Could there still be political local rows going on?
Oh. Okay. Could there?
Right.
There will be. There's no doubt about that.
There will be.
So what Barratt is showing here is on the face of it, you would think, oh, God, they've got 10 years worth of supply. Mm. They don't own that.
Yeah.
They own 3 years of that land.
They own the option to do a deal if there is a deal to be done.
In the future.
We don't know if there's a deal to be done.
And that can take years. Okay. Now, why do Barratt show this? And I'm not just picking on Barratt, but it's all the big boys. Well, they've got their shareholders to please as well. And of course, a report and accounts is an advertising document, a marketing document at the end of the day. So they're trying to show a rosy picture, which is misleading slightly, because it's not reality. This might happen in the next 10 years.
Which gives rise to the allegation that they're sitting on loads of
huge land banks.
But
because until Man With Big Red Stamp comes along and says, yes, you can't put a spade in the ground. You can't do anything.
Yes.
And so a lot of this will be agricultural land that's been allocated for planning but isn't there yet. And they're all the same. These land banks are not reality yet.
Okay.
And you've got to think of a Barratt. I mean, Ian said 3 to 5 years to build a site. They employ huge workforces.
Yes.
They have to have something to move on to. So they finish a site, they've got to have other things to move on to. Otherwise, they're making people redundant. So... these are very well-run machines that, you know, it's a sausage machine, ultimately. It just keeps moving.
It's good. So there's dramatically fewer of these small and medium developers.
Yeah.
And the large builders are producing less. So that's the supply side. What's happening from the other side?
Right,
the demand.
Demand. This is where we sort of start speculating a bit on what the size of the UK population is. Right, okay. So we think, the Office for National Statistics tell us that, and I've got some dates here. In 1999, there were 58.6 million people in the country.
Okay, possible. Yeah.
2009, there were 62.3 million people in the country.
Okay, well, that's...
reasonable progression.
Basically, any number after 1997, I'm less inclined to trust the veracity of the...
and I'll prove this to you now. So 2019, there were allegedly just under 67 million people in the country. So there were 67 million people in 2019. If you look at the ONS's projection in 2021 for population growth, it was 67,530,759. That was what we were supposed to have in 2021.
Yeah.
In 2022, it was 67,844,183. So in the year 2022, the population was going to grow according to the ONS projection, by 313,000 people.
How many people did it actually?
606,000.
Right.
So there were net. That is net migration. That's net migration only into the country. That doesn't also calculate population growth of the existing population.
And that's only the ones that they actually capture as well.
Good point. Well made.
Even assuming.
Yeah.
But their numbers are right. They're badly underestimating the growth.
Absolutely.
But we know that these numbers aren't right. It's almost certainly higher. I mean, I remember, food analysts, for example, food analysts talk about this, sewage works analysts. They all point out the amount going in and out of a human being, basically.
Is more than it is, yeah.
You more cannot than account for a population of this size. It has to be, yeah, you know, 10 to 20 yeah million larger than, yeah, than these numbers.
So if you take this, so 600,000 people came into the country,
yeah,
last year. If you assume, and this is a hell of an assumption, they were all four-person families, which we know they weren't.
Images would suggest it's more single young men, yeah, than families, yeah, of four, but okay.
But 600,000 four-person families,
yes,
is housing demand of 150,000 units last year, an increase. We needed 150,000.
So on a very generous assumption, yeah, but they're all, yeah, four-person families,
yeah,
just for immigration,
we needed 100.
Just for that 150,000 houses.
Yeah.
How many do we actually produce at
the moment? 191,000.
Right. So it's, okay, it's 40,000 for the natural population.
Yeah. And we know they're not all four-person families as well.
Yes.
Agreed.
Yes.
Right. Well, you can all agree on that.
Yes.
So the production of houses, units, because they won't all be houses, some will be flats, in the UK doesn't satisfy population growth through immigration alone. So then you're ignoring the fact that more people live on their own today. You're ignoring the fact that the population is aging. So there's a natural need for more houses. You're ignoring second home ownership, which is an increasing trend. That in itself kind of tells you why demand is outstripping supply.
But even if the politicians got their wish and it was 300,000 houses a year.
Still not enough.
Yeah, that mm, even
still
that
not enough.
Be enough.
Yeah.
Scratches the surface.
And, but we're not even getting that.
And something we'll come back to after we include Ian Moore in the pod now is, yeah, I'm of the opinion, I suspect, housing supply is going to drop because of some of the factors we talk about here. And this is why I said to you when we started, I want to talk about the banking industry as well. I think we're never going to get to the 300,000. And actually, it's entirely possible that this year we don't produce the same, we'll be lower than we produced last year.
Because, well, every data point you've given me so far shows that supply just goes down and demand just goes up.
Yeah.
So yeah, the lines are,
yeah,
heading away from each other, yeah, quite fast.
And we've seen, what really worries me is every recession you have, you see a,
yes,
drop in the number of house builders.
That's also been clear from this, yeah.
I mean, it's clear to me we're in recession now.
Yes. So, Ian, he just painted a fairly pessimistic picture from supply and demand. Help us get into the nitty and gritty. Give us a basic overview of the process of actually building a house.
Okay. So you start by trying to identify a possible site that you could develop, which in our experience is mostly brownfield. So existing urban land, if you like. Yeah. So having identified something that you think might be suitable for development, you've then got to negotiate with the owner in order to strike a deal to be able to buy that. And that's after you've checked that it's within the urban boundary, therefore it's likely to be developable. If it's outside the urban boundary, there's every chance that you wouldn't be able to develop it in the first place. So you've gone through a bit of thinking and a bit of process and some negotiation. And
presumably you've had to do search to make sure there's not pipes or electric cables.
A whole raft of research to make sure that lots of different factors aren't going to be an immovable problem.
And one of the biggest
they can fall into lots of different categories, from ecology, yeah, to categorization of land, to where it is, to drainage, a whole raft of things that could be an absolute brick wall that stops you ever developing it.
And this, something I'd throw in here as well, sorry to interrupt.
No, go for it.
There's still a certain amount of EU legislation which makes a lot of developable land undevelopable. I'm referring to SSSI here.
Yeah.
If you are within a certain distance of a, I'm going to get it wrong now,
site of special scientific interest,
you can't develop.
So if you're within 400 metres of the boundary of a SSSI categorised piece of land,
yes,
you can't build. You won't get residential permission.
How often does that come up?
Because, I mean, it's all over the country.
You go off and have a look, presumably, at possible housing sites all the time.
One of the first things we check is how close is it to the nearest SSSI.
Oh, so they're all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And they're lots of different sizes as well, because the definition is all about how valuable is the site scientifically.
So how often do you, I'm trying to think through the ratio of how often somebody gets in touch and say, I've got a bit of land I might be interested in selling, to you actually making an offer?
You could, for example, send out 200 letters across an area, a county, and you might get two or three replies. If you're lucky, you might get one piece of land that becomes a deal. But that might take a year to get there.
Okay. Well, with the process you've described, it sounds like it would take at least a year.
Well, in terms of negotiating and figuring out whether it's developable, then you go to what are you going to put on it? So you're talking to architects and you're figuring out what you could actually get on the land. Then you're going through the whole planning process, which is all about having a set of plans drawn up, the relevant statements that go with it, all the surveys that have to go into even lodging an application, from ecology to drainage to land filtration tests and all the other things you have to do to submit an application. Then
okay,
the council,
so we haven't even begun the process of talking to the local council yet. All we've
done
is checked if I'm allowed to build. If there's not water mains or electricity, there's not slow worms, there's not bats, there's not
exactly. All
trees.
Those things you can think of, you've got to tick all those off.
Okay.
And then, you, of course, as part of your application, you're putting in an ecological statement, which leads to a biodiversity mitigation plan.
Sorry, a biodiversity mitigation plan.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's just come back to that for a minute, because
right,
that's a whole other subject. So there's a whole raft of things you do. Then you submit your plans. The council are then usually obliged to determine the application within 8 weeks. But usually, not always, but let's say in most instances, they're unable to determine in that time because they've got staff shortages or a whole raft of other things that councils have to do. So you get to an appeal situation. And when you get to an appeal situation, you stand more chance of getting a grant, but you've got to wait probably 8 months for it.
So you go to the council and you've at this point done all of your box ticking.
Yes.
So do you present them with a big wad of paperwork?
Effectively.
Okay, which is we've checked all of those things and then they look at it and go, oh, they have checked them.
Yep.
Or do they go off and do their own checks?
They verify everything that you're telling them. So, for example, you submit a hydrological survey of the land you want to build on, which shows that it drains adequately and it's not going to flood, just as an example. Okay. So they will look at the report you've given them, which will have been done by a consultant who's qualified to actually do that work. And assuming they agree with it, then they tick that box and that piece of the equation.
So there's
done.
A whole industry of consultants out there whose job it is to say this bit of land will drain and do that.
Correct.
And then there's presumably a batman who does the, you know, there's no...
Ecologists.
Yes, ecologists. And
yep.
Or arboriculturalists.
Trees.
Trees is a
big one. So there's a whole army of these people out there who just go around looking at land, giving people like you pieces of paper saying it's okay.
But it's worse than that, Dan, because we'll have those people on our side and the council have the same set of people on their side and they all have to agree.
They have, and if they disagree, then there has to be a negotiation about how to deal with what they disagree
about.
How often
do they disagree?
Mostly.
So I'm starting to get clues into my head as to why house prices might be high and why everything in general in this country costs more.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.